Alrighty, I am Courtney Lytle, and today we're talking about copyright. I'm an attorney locally. I have a practice here in town. I also teach at Emory Law School, teaching copyrights and that sort of stuff. I am not a litigator, so to the extent we start talking a little bit about trials and that sort of stuff, yeah, I'll be making that part up because I don't know. I do corporate work. I draft contracts. I keep my clients out of trouble. I tend to think of the corporate folks like me. We're kind of the diplomats. We're the governments trying to keep war from happening. The litigators, the mercenaries, they go in and win shit. That's not my job. My job is to keep from getting to that stage. As a general rule, and I enjoy saying this more when I'm on a panel with some litigators, so I get some pushback instantly as opposed to maybe someone in the audience. My job as a corporate lawyer was to try to put the litigators out of business. Because if you go to trial, the only one who really wins is the litigators. I mean, Apple and Google, I'm sure y'all have been following some of those cases back and forth and back and forth over the same stupid couple of patents. I say stupid couple of patents. Gajillions of dollars worth of intellectual property. And they've been suing each other in different jurisdictions. And I have no idea how much either of them will actually make at the end of it if they ever settle that. But in the meantime, they've made some lawyers really happy. Some lawyers have nice boats and their kids have all gone through college on this lawsuit. So litigation often benefits the litigators. One of the problems with our system, which I'll get to in a second, is that to litigate requires a whole bunch of money. My people don't work cheap.
Right.
And so if it takes litigation to solve your problem, you've ended up the wrong route if you're a normal human. Now, if you're Apple or Google, yeah, sure. Go to court, make some law, move along. For normal humans, it's usually not much of an option. If, I mean, a reasonably priced copyright lawyer will be, yeah. If you're lucky, you can get one for $450 or $500 an hour. Add that up, and you can figure out pretty quick. Now, keep in mind, lawyers bill you in six-minute increments. So, you know, every tenth of an hour, they're billing you some more. And if you talk to them for 1 minute, they bill you for six. But it and you think that doesn't have to do. So, litigation is usually not your answer. I come from the opposite side of it, but I'm also an academic, so I can talk all day about copyright law. What I will try to do instead is give you kind of a brief overview. What the law is, what it isn't, what it does for you, and what it doesn't do for you. And we'll have some time for questions, because generally there's a whole bunch of folks with questions, which is often why you're here. I'm working from the assumption most of y'all are either interested in protecting content or, you know, you're creative on some level. You're DragonCon, you're creative to start with. But a lot of folks here want to be authors or artists or something like that, and I can address some of those questions, either specific ones or general ones, as we get towards the end. But we're going to start with an overview. Copyright law. I need like angels and birds and stuff hanging down a banner. Exactly, there we go. That's it. My people. So you can see the beautiful banner that says copyright law. Copyright law is a federal law. So your states aren't really involved. It's you and the federal government. It is indeed in the Constitution. You have a constitutional right to your copyright. There's three main areas of intellectual property and one sort of bonus one. So we're going to talk about first the ones that we're not talking about. Patents. We can get rid of that really quick because I'm not smart enough to be a patent lawyer. Patent is that strange hybrid of people who can survive both law school and science. They exist. I'm on panels with them occasionally. They're smarter than I am. I took astronomy for my science. And the second semester was hard. The first part was Greeks and stars and stuff. I was good at that. When I actually got to chemistry, that was almost like real science. Most lawyers really stink at science. In fact, the standard that we know in our practice is that if I could do math and science, I'd be a doctor. And lawyers all kind of go, it's funny because it's true. But patent lawyers are a different breed. Patents are about science. They are about inventions. They're about things that are practical and do things. These are your medicines. These are your machines. These are stupid things also. They're now business methods. There is a legitimate patent for swinging sideways on a swing. Many of you got in trouble with the recess lady for going sideways on the swing instead of forwards and back. You can't do it anymore. You're violating a patent.
What?
But I kid you not. I had to pull it up. I thought, oh, that's one of those urban myths. No, it's real. It is a legitimate U.S. patent. The patent office smokes a lot of crap. But the so a patent is not what we're talking about today. That's if you've invented something. If you've come up with something cool that does something. It has a purpose. It's often a science thing. That's not us today. The next one that most people think about and really get confused around, I have one. Ooh, there we go. Steven, the trademark I expected. Look, it's a caramel-colored beverage with fizz and caffeine and a distinctive red mark. This mark that tells us today is Coke, because they lost 4 years ago, tells you that you know what's in this bottle. That's what trademarks are all about. It's brand names or company names that identify the source of either the good or the service. In the past, I just steal things from great companies. I'm being nice to you. So a trademark is really about, believe it or not, consumer protection. It's not to benefit Coke and Disney, although we usually think of it that way. It's not just to let Coke protect their name at all costs, and boy, they do a good job of it. Don't take on the Coke trademark lawyers. They'll mess you up. So, but trademark is so when you buy the pinch-shaped bottle with the distinctive red lettering on it, you know what you're getting. That's why trademarks are there. They are a Consumer Protection Act that identifies the source of the good or service. So that's not usually what we're talking about when we're talking about art and books and those kinds of things and movies. Trade secrets is the other little bitty one that's not as big a deal, but it's important to some companies. In fact, the same company whose distinctive trademark we just looked at has one of the most famous trade secrets in the world, which is the formula for Coca-Cola. It literally is in a vault in the Big Red Tower down the road from here. No shit, big vault they built just for it. Trade secret is something that is useful to your business. It can be a consumer, it can be a customer list. It can be a way of doing business. It can be the formula for Coke. It can be the formula for KFC, which used to be called Kentucky Fried Chicken. And they used to have Colonel Sanders as their spokesperson. He actually founded the restaurant, and his 11 herbs and spices are indeed a trade secret. You can't just look them up and find them. If a trade secret is anything useful to your business that you keep secret. If you keep it secret and take reasonable steps to keep it secret, then you get some extra help from the government if someone tries to steal it or succeeds in stealing it. They put a woman in jail from Coca-Cola who had access to the vault and swiped a copy of the formula and called Pepsi saying, hey, guess what I got? And Pepsi said, oh, for the love of God, we don't want to be involved with this, and promptly called the FBI, who called the guys in the Big Red Tower, who set up a sting and took the secretary to jail. They take this seriously.
Why is it KFC instead of Kentucky Fried Chicken?
It's their new modern hip logo.
Because they don't want to have fried in their name.
I guess they don't want fried in their name, and honestly, they may not want Kentucky in their name
acronyms
either. I don't know.
Acronyms are pretty popular.
Yeah, it and makes them seem cool.
And I think KFC is easier to trademark than Kentucky Fried Chicken.
No, they have Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh,
that's their mark.
Okay.
I mean, now, they'll have to disclaim parts of it. You can't own chicken for chicken and all of that
right.
sort of thing. But the whole mark, Kentucky Fried Chicken, they do own.
Okay.
So you can't, but that's different. You can't. So copyright is the rest
that
of
panel,
it.
That panel happened yesterday.
Oh, excellent. I didn't even have to do it. So Kentucky Fried Chicken, Coca-Cola, those are your trademarks. Polio vaccine, those sorts of things are your patents. And swinging sideways on the swing. Copyright is the rest of it. It's the art. It's the music. It's the films. It's the copyright speeches. It's the novels. Now, it is creative. It's not intended to cover facts or anything that's a process or anything that, frankly, is useful at all. Copyright is all about form, not function. So, for instance, if I were to write a book that has a whole lot of useful facts in it, none of those facts are protected. Someone else can't just come in and copy my book, but they can pluck each fact out and use it in their own book, even if I discover those facts. If I were to go do lots of research in England and I actually find King Arthur's grave, I can prove it's him, I get all of the history, I've read all these old English things, I'm much more educated than I actually am, I discover the tomb, and I write my book saying, hey, look, here it is. Here's all these documents proving it. Isn't this cool as hell? Well, it is cool. And I own my book. I have a copyright in my book, which would be the words I use to express those facts. The facts themselves are not mine. If someone else goes through, finds my book, says, hey, that is cool. Yeah, but her writing stinks. I can do better than that, and I already have an agent. Ha-ha. And writes a book. Every fact is exactly the same, but they just retell it in their own words. And they publish it. I can't stop them. I don't own those facts, just my expression of it. So it's the expression of the idea or the expression of the facts that copyright covers. Now, one of the big squishy lines is where does the idea stop and my expression start? Well, assuming Shakespeare still had a valid patent on, you know, say Romeo and Juliet, somewhere around boy meets girl, things go badly. He doesn't own that idea. Someone else could write that. somewhere between that basic idea and the full text of Romeo and Juliet, it became sufficiently fleshed out, sufficiently detailed, that it was Shakespeare's expression of that basic idea. Where that line is, academics love to talk about it, judges sometimes have to find it. How much can you take? Well, maybe not that much. So somewhere the expression becomes real, and that's where copyright attaches. If I put a painting on the wall, yeah, that'd probably be really mad if it's ruining the wall. But if I painted on that wall, if I painted a horse, because that's what I would probably paint, the idea of a horse painting, even if I did something clever like they have down at the art show, there's that really distinctive painting with the red scarves wrapped around the horse's legs, which, as an equestrian, I found kind of disturbing. It's like, oh, they're going to back up and break their legs. So I don't want that one on my wall. Beautiful, but disturbing. That idea of drawing a horse, I don't own it. Even if I drew horse with disturbing red scarves, the idea of horse with scarves, someone else can do it. My way of painting it, no one else can copy it. No one wants it. I really have no interest in that. Yes, see, there's the problem. It's mushy.
Yeah.
Now, the idea, so horse with red scarf. How many of y'all have seen that painting, by the way, in the art show? Okay, so a lot of y'all have seen that. So at least six of you in the audience know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to focus this for a really, really long time, for those six people. So the idea of the horses with the silk scarves, I assume they're silk, they're red, twisted around their legs, they're kind of holding their legs out to each other with the scarves wrapped and up through a bracket in the center. So the idea of a horse painting, anyone can do that. The idea of two horses, anyone can do that. The idea of two horses with a bracket, we're still absolutely good. Two horses with some scarves, okay, still good. When you start wrapping a distinctive red scarf around both legs through a bracket, somewhere you've now copied that painting, if you've seen it. In copyright, unlike patent, individual creation keeps you from being an infringer. In patents, if I were to suddenly discover in my lab how to vaccinate against polio, that patent's valid. Assume that's still a valid patent for purposes of my discussion. If I invented it independently, it doesn't matter. I still can't use it because the patent holds against anyone else doing the same thing. Copyright is only against people copying. So if I had come up with that idea for the horses in the red scarves before I saw that painting in the art show, I could do it. And I wouldn't be copying it because I hadn't seen the original. For famous works, sometimes that doesn't work. George Harrison was found to have infringed a chiffon's number. But because he was subconsciously infringing, it was a famous song. He's so fine. It's a famous song, and so they assumed that he had heard it. Probably he had. He was in the music industry. Everyone had heard it. There was only top 40 radio at that time. So everyone had heard that song, so they found the similarity between My Sweet Lord and He's So Fine to be a subconscious infringement. They were not willing to say that George Harrison intentionally ripped off the chiffons, but they were willing to say that he unintentionally copied them. So famous work, they may find that even if you don't think you copied it, you did. But a work like that one down in the art show, if any of you had decided to paint horses with red scarves before you saw that painting, you're not infringing, even if you actually painted the exact same thing, because you didn't copy it. You independently created it. Copyright is thinner protection than patents for that reason. So your idea, expression, independent creation. If I come up with it by myself, I can copyright it. You may end up with two copyrights on a very similar thing. I, in fact, recently copyrighted my son's art, not because it's good, but because, you know, he's my son. And my mom thought it would be really cool. And since I usually piss my mom off on a regular basis, but then I could do something that made her happy real easily, so I went for it. $35 later, my son has a copyright on Love Birds. It's little birds made out of parts. It's very cute. I'm assuming he's not the first person to draw a bird that's sort of shaped like a heart and call it a love bird, but maybe he is. But he has a copyright on it. Now I'm going to be doing the copying, so I told you about it. But if someone else had done that without knowing it, you know, there could be 100 copyrights for that same kind of drawing. Who knows? Most kids doing that level drawing don't have broken parents who will register a copyright for them. But some do. Some kid had a dad who registered a patent for him for swinging sideways on the swing. What can you do? So copyright is going to protect your expression. When you're talking about music, you have multiple levels of copyright. You've got the composition, you've got the score, you've got all sorts of different aspects that go into it. Licensing music is much more complicated than licensing other things. When you're talking about books, though, the big thing is trying to avoid facts. Those are covered. Ideas. This is a big one that you get all the time from people, you know, in the hallways afterwards. will say things like, oh, I've got this great idea. How can I protect it? Write it down. You can't protect it when it's in your head. If you want to protect it while it's just an idea, don't tell anyone. There. No one can steal it from you. But if someone else thinks of the same idea and does something with it, you can't stop them. And frankly, if you come up with an idea and you do protect it and someone else comes with it, up with it on their own, you can't, well, you can sue them, but you lose. This, by the way, is the reason that you pretty much can no longer send a submission to any of the movie studios anymore with a screenplay. Because they have learned that that just leads to bad things. So they won't open them. If it's an unsolicited proposal, an unsolicited screenplay, or does not come from an agent with whom they do business, they will not open it. If they have opened it by mistake, they will not read it. It's absolutely all of their corporate policies, because that way you can't have someone who wrote just an absolute piece of garbage with the idea of, you know, two cops, one is older and about to retire, one's really kind of broken and rough around the edges, and they have adventures, some of which involve international criminals, and girls keep dying. Well, okay, there's Lethal Weapon. But if you sent that in a really poor screenplay to a studio, they're not using that, really. Shane Black did Lethal Weapon without that help. But someone will somewhere think, but I sent that movie into them, it's the same thing. Studios won't read them anymore, because if they created it on their own and didn't copy you, doesn't matter if you have the same idea. Well, see, there's the reason that when they do copy, they get away with it. You can't prove it, really. But they can make it easier to prove that they didn't copy yours by not opening it. You can send it all day long, they're not going to read it, and everyone now knows that they won't read it. So when you go to court saying, yeah, but I sent that to you, I think you read it, they can say, our corporate policy is never to read any of that stuff, and they're telling the truth. Yes? Absolutely not. Poor Man's Copyright is one of my favorite things. I had never heard of it until partway through my practice. And it reminded me very distinctly, this time help you fix it in your head, when I was lifeguarding age, I took a first aid course. And among the things they taught us, many of which were kind of gross, they showed us, when we got to treating burns, even just the little line drawings they did in the first aid handbook were really icky when they got to third degree burns. Reason number 508, I'm not a doctor. Icky. Well, one of the things they tell you about a third degree burn is don't put butter on it. Okay. They don't actually mention other condiments. They don't mention mayonnaise. They never say Crisco, but they say don't do butter. Well, as was pointed out here, yeah, that's an old wives' tale, that it's a folk remedy, that putting butter on a burn will help take, copyright at that point, because even though I didn't have notes for this, it's now being fixed in a tangible medium.
that's protected. Now it's video footage. But 1 to 6 is protectable. So once you write it down, you're covered. Now, so you can say, I wrote it then, and people say, prove it. You'll say, that Shape the Dragon Don told me it was protected. Well, it is. But if it's something that you care about, you think you're going to want to make money off of, file it. You don't have to file it prior to 1976. You had to file or get a copyright. There are a whole bunch of formalities to any of them up, your copyright is destroyed. That's no longer the law. Once you fix it in the medium, it's protected. But if you ever really want to enforce that copyright, you have to file it. Filing is easy. You, www.copyright.gov. Library of Congress runs copyright system. Copyright.gov, you go through, you basically tell them the type of work it is, your name, and you have to give them a copy of it. And a surprisingly short period of time later, you get a little copyright certificate in the mail. Done. $35, and you're out. And you do not need a lawyer's dues, okay? When you're talking about patents, you've got to have a lawyer to do a patent. Don't, if it's something you care enough about to do a patent, you've got to have a lawyer, and you need a patent. Don't hire someone like me. Even if Google screwed up. Do not use a patent agent. They say they can do it, but it's important enough to waste your money to file a patent, get a patent lawyer to file your patent for you. For a trademark, those have to be filed, and those you can file yourself, but it's not a pain in the butt. There's an online process through the USPTO, Patent Trademark Office, and you can go through that, and there'll be questions you don't know the answer to. And you have to take the classifications of existing services. And there'll be stuff you're not sure how to do, but there is a helpline, and as long as you're not asking them legal questions, they will help you figure out how to file. And they're fairly helpful. And there's two levels of big fees to pay. One is, I got this. And the other is, I'm pretty sure I have this right. You pay an extra $20 or something for the, I'm pretty sure I have this right level of filing. And when you screw something up, the patent or the trademark examiner will email you and say, okay, this is wrong, you have to change this, and this is wrong, you have to change this. And honestly, you can get it right. I think the examiners have to feel like they're earning their keep. So they'll take a sentence and say, well, you identified that as medium blue. I think you need to call it dark medium blue. I can run that happens. Really? Dark medium blue. I'm not even going to run that by my client, Gilbert. Yes, I approve that change and trademark. So you can do a trademark without a lawyer, you can have a pain in the ass, but you can do it. And at least you'll probably ask trademark questions, but as long as you perform your answers, as long as you don't do something that sounds like asking legal advice, just better do this or this. That's a lawyer question. How do I fill out this blank? That's one. So make sure your questions are, how do I fill out the form? And they'll help you. You can do it. Copyrights, you don't need a lawyer even in the room. It's online, it's simple. I couldn't make my question exactly. Intent. So copyright is simple and it's cheap. If you're like a photographer and you have tons of pictures, okay, $35 a pop starts to be seen. This is a collective work. You put a whole bunch together and file it once. $35. So if your poor man's copyright, you're really the thrill. And if you really want to mail it to yourself, that's fine. You mail it to me, that's fine too. I don't have to email. But no, that'd be okay. I'll get the questions in a second. I'm going to finish the overview, and then we'll get to the specific questions. I lose my train of thought. Why do that? So we've talked about the idea of expression. We've talked about filing. Filing gives you rights to your copyright. The term of copyright is fairly generous now. The work is the life of the author plus 70 years. So 70 years after you're dead, your heirs can still be enjoying the fruits of your labor. The old copyright law, which is why a lot of older people are already in the public domain, had two terms. If you didn't renew after the first, depends on what year, but number of years, then you lost your copyright at that point. If you renewed, you got a second term. There's now only one term in copyright, and it lasts life of the author plus 70 years. The idea being that's long as most artists are not in. Dead artists are famous ones. They start making money after they're dead. Well, this way the Buddhists and children get their money off. That's the idea. So we talked about art, we talked about that, we talked about facts, we talked about writing your novel, we talked about filing. I'm going to let the man with the box decide who was first, but I'm going to pitch into this part.
Oh, awesome. Someone over there. I have a writing group, and they've gotten weird recently, and they put, yeah, sorry, redundant there, my bad. And they've started, they've started to write copyright on their drafts. You know, we critique each other, and you were talking about putting down fixed, and I knew that's when it kind of kicked in, but just putting copyright.
From the previous act.
Yeah.
The previous act, 1909 Act, the previous copyright act. The new act in the 76 Act, I'm not sure, but in active time was closed. So the new act, the 76 Act, which for those of you playing along at home, actually went into effect January 1st, 1978. It's the 76 Act, and the 76 Act changed that. Among the formalities that were dropped, the need for notes. Under the 09 Act, if you didn't have the theme of the circle and the correct formulation, and you published it without that on it, it fell into public domain and your copyright died. That was one of the formalities we talked about. Had filed, said file before you published, filed a tax today. So you had filed before you published, you had published with the correct notice, and you wanted to renew it, you had to renew it within the right window. Which if you wrote one great novel, it's easy. If you were, you know, a short story author and you filed things, it was, you know, counted 18 or 36 years from the date, not even from January 1 of that year, the date of publication. So you as a short story author would have to keep track of everything you published and when it was published to make sure that you reviewed everything. Yeah, like that. With an artist, you have to keep track of which day you finished each painting or which day you displayed each painting and make sure you renewed the right number of years after that day. Yeah, right. Artists are known for keeping track of details really well. They're really good details of money. Let's see how they're painting. That is new. So notice is one of those formalities. If you publish it without that notice on it, then you lost your copyright. Today, notice is permissive, we call it. You do it if you want, but you don't have to. Now, I recommend if you're circulating something like on the internet, go ahead and put that notice on there. Because along with putting butter on a burn and mailing yourself your transcript, a lot of people still believe that if the mark isn't on there, that it's not protected. So think of it kind of like the car lock. It keeps on people honest. A lot of people keep stuff on the internet think it doesn't say copyright, they're allowed to take it. They're not. They're infringing, but they think they can have it.
So put that on there, just alerting them that I don't want you to steal this. It doesn't do any harm. It is no longer necessary, but you know what the hell? Lock your car, put the notice on. Okay. Back to our moderator and he will pitch it to
cool.
Someone else.
I
wasn't paying attention, so take it.
I've been working on a book that uses a lot of dictionary entries, basically. Do those fall under use of facts as being unprotected, or...?
If you are copying the dictionary reference, if you're copying the dictionary entry from Merriam-Webster or something,
yeah.
Then yes, you're infringing.
Okay, but if I put it in my own words...
If you put it in your own words, no dictionary can own the meaning of that word.
Okay.
And there's only so many ways what a word means. But do it in your own words and you're fine. Make sure
okay.
It's not. And if I were you and trying to avoid trouble, I would go and look. I would write it in my own words first. Then I would look at how, you know, top three dictionaries do it and make sure it didn't happen to be identical to those.
Okay.
If it is changing a word or two so it's not listed out. But no dictionary can own the meaning of the words. And one of the copyright things is when you have something in which there are few or only one way to express something, then no one can own it. but those are the ways you express it, and no one gets to own those. So dictionary reference is the same thing.
Thanks. Do I toss it back to you, or?
I'll try to the moderator.
Okay.
I'm putting this all on you, hon, because I wasn't talking when their arms went up. Okay. I'll post you after the panel.
Nope. Up here.
Thank you. My question is, you speak of
once the work is in a tangible medium. Mm-hmm. Now, this has two sides to the question. Tangible medium, would that possibly be a rewritable tangible medium, such as...
Your computer counts. The memory on your computer counts. As once you've typed it into your computer, that counts as chiseling in stone. That's tangible.
Okay, and once it's in stone on the hard drive, that means I can't edit it further?
Oh, sure you can.
Okay.
As you change it, you have a new work that's fixed in tangible medium. Now, I don't recommend sending every version of your draft to the copyright office. Wait till you're done, and then protect it.
Thanks.
And if you change it later, well, okay, then file that version. But you don't have, I wouldn't do, you know, every draft you're doing. Don't file every chapter, it'll make you crazy. You can, there's no rule against it. But wait till you're done, then file it. But know in your heart of hearts you're protected because you have that federal protection as soon as you wrote it. Even if it's crap, you have protection.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, he asked my question, so I'll ask, will you cover fair use? Which apparently is getting real gnarly.
Okay, fair use, my favorite topic. The answer to fair use is no one has a clue. Fair use is what artists like to say they are claiming when they take someone else's idea. If someone else has written something and you want to use it, fan fiction, they always say, I want to write that story about Perfect Spot because no one else has written it. That's okay, I think it's written. And I'm going to write that story. Well, I'm using characters in a setting and a whole bunch of details that someone else already made. They own it. I really can't do it. My work is a derivative work. A derivative work is one of the right adaptations on the right to cover. Performance, copying, distribution, all of those things owner gets to do. And adaptation, or doing a derivative work, is another of those rights. You can't do that. It's an infringement. Period. However, there is defense to that action of infringement, and that defense is fair use. In the statute, there's four prongs to it. They made up some other stuff that isn't in the statute that they use. They ignore some of the stuff that's in the statute. The litigators go apes over fair use because they will call anything fair use, whether it belongs to them or not, and you don't know it until the end of the trial, whether your use is fair or not. The four elements are supposed to be waived, and it's things like, what is the underlying work? Is it something that's back dab in the middle of the pocket, like a painting? Is it a book with facts? Because it's a fact, you know, if it's a history book, then maybe you're more likely to be able to use something out of it. If it's purely creative, you're less likely to. How much of that underlying work do you use in yours? If you just take a little bit of it? Now, if you're allowed to, for instance, quote a book if you're writing a literary critique of it. You don't have to not quote the work when you're critiquing the work, doing a review of the work, that's fine. Arguably, you could take an entry out of the dictionary without being in trouble. But why ask to be sued? Change, you know, make it in your own words, and you're good to go. Don't ask for trouble. Don't copy stuff. If you really feel, and I'm sorry, how much you use, what you use, and then it's, well, what did you do to it? Did you transform it? This is what litigators get rich. Transformative use. It's not in the statute. It's stuff they made up and is now a huge body of law, completely unpredictable. And an expensive trial to find out if it's transformative or not. Transformative means you've absolutely changed it. You've taken, let's go to the Obama campaign poster. That was a transformative use of the underlying photograph, which the artist Jeffrey Ferry didn't bother to get permission for. He infringed it and turned it into that campaign poster. He got sued for it.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
They settled. They settled, so we don't know who would have won. He claimed it was a transformative use. Everyone else was having said, you moron, why didn't you pay the $20 to get permission to use the photo? And that's my advice for transformative stuff. When you're trying to use fair use, when you want to take someone else's stuff, ask. A lot of times they'll let you. They're, and especially to something like a... Well, parody and satire, in theory, you don't have to ask their permission. That's another technical fair use. And parody has been expanded well beyond anything y'all think is parody. None of these terms mean what you think they mean, because lawyers can stop calling them too long ago, sounding them. And the problem with fair use is you don't know for sure. And on a practical level, it comes down to who's got more money, you or the guy whose work you're using. Chances are the guy whose work you're using has more money, especially if it goes to a movie studio or Paramount, or you know, anyone who owns a whole bunch of content. They have their own lawyers already.
So if they sue you and say you're infringing, you can say, oh yes, there's a fair use, so they find help to judge. Well, to get to the judge requires some of my people and it's expensive. So relying on fair use, if you're ready to go to trial, it may be fine. And you may lose. There's a lovely article that I have my students read, written 25 years ago by a noted judge up in the Northeast. And he writes about how, well, fair use has gotten kind of confusing, and even I, as a really smart judge, never really know the right answer because the law has become so marshy. But I'm absolutely certain that with the current trend, that it's going to really clarify right back out really soon. Yeah, he wrote that article a long time ago. It's gotten worse. So your use may indeed be a fair one. And Shepard Fairey, I think he would have won his case against the AP unless the judge came down on a very pragmatic level, which is, why the hell didn't you ask permission? And that's one of the things that judges look at. Could you have gotten permission? So if you can license the use, you're too cheap to pay the license fee, yeah, you're not going to win at fair use. Whether you're selling it or not matters, but not completely. Even if your use is a purely non-commercial one, you can still be found guilty of infringement. So the fact that you're not selling it doesn't mean you're not infringing. Oh, that's another misperception. If you're selling it, it's worse, and you're more likely to lose on fair use. But even if you're not selling it, it's still infringement. Ask permission. Come up with your own ideas. You guys are clever, intelligent people. You are creative if you're creating stuff. Create your own stuff. Don't steal other people's stuff. Shepard Fairey, ironically, is really good at suing people when he thinks his stuff is just going. But boy, was he standing and making a big, strong statement about his rights to use that, his rights to transform, and all this other stuff, about freedom of expression. Let's copy these, and that's different. He will sue you in a heartbeat. But boy, was he all on free expression when he was going. So does that cover fair use for you? Is there a specific question about it you want me to answer?
It would be too much detail, but a friend of mine is a photographer in San Francisco. I take pictures too. He says photographers, they get stolen from now, and there's nothing they can do about it, no matter what they do.
That's fairly true. Everything is digital. It's on the internet. It's really easy to copy and steal stuff. And you can now, photographers, what I usually advise is, yeah, you can't keep them from taking it, but put your copyright on there.
Yeah.
As loud and blatant as you can, so at least if they're distributing it, maybe your name's in.
He says they just say, okay, well, we're using it, and we're powerful, we got more money than you, sue me.
And unfortunately, that's often the case. Whoever has the most money wins, regardless of what the law would say. But that's, maybe realism, but negative thinking and not very helpful from a legal panel. So, to a certain extent, the guy with the money wins. But if you do have a fair use, but your photographer friend, his stuff's getting ripped off all the time. Most photographers are. And there's not a good answer. If you can find a way to encrypt it, that keeps some people from taking it. I mean, a lot of people can lift your copyright right off of it, too. But some can't. So at least if your pictures are being distributed without your permission, your name's going with them. That's something. So especially for easily stealable stuff like that, I'd say, by all means, smack that copyright notice on it. That'll keep maybe some honest people from stealing it. And at least when people downstream see it, they know who to contact and who is the really cool guy that took the picture in the first place. So at least get some credit, maybe. Okay.
Kind of touched on this a little bit, but I wrote a fan fiction that I wanted to self-publish, but I use a pretty famous celebrity in a different context, and I was worried about, like, if I could get away with it under parody law. I know. It's like a can of worms.
The best advice I give is ask. See if you're allowed to use it. Like, if you just write it to, fan fiction conventions usually would pass around before panels started, or they had different panels to share your fan fiction. At that point, none of the companies cared because they recognized it for what it is. You're a fan, being so turned on by your universe or your movie or your franchise that they want to keep being in that universe. Well, they want, and they're going to come here because other people like that, and they keep doing that between movies, between TV shows, whatever. And they thought that was great. Well, now people are publishing it. And now people are making money off of it. And now the studios tend to say, wait a minute, that should be our money. And so now they're starting to come down on it. And the more visible your piece of fan fiction becomes, the more likely you are to get stopped on. And if you're also using an individual celebrity, well, that is a celebrity. It's much more likely to come after you than the studio, because unless it's really,
I basically turn Rod Stewart into an action star.
He might like that.
That's what I was thinking.
He's certainly nicer with Hal Hartman. So he may be okay with it. Because he said, yes, then you're fine. And he's not one who's known for being vicious. Now, if it's a parody, Hal Hartman got away with it, but they can get sued a lot. And to a certain extent, when it's a blatant parody by someone with money, well, if Rod Stewart had to use South Park, well, they used his name and his likeness, but they were using it as a parody. They would have had enough lawyers. They probably did not go with that. You're allowed to make fun of people, but you're not allowed to, for instance, use his face to sell acting without his permission. So where that line is drawn is going to depend, again. And the law has changed recently, and it's not one that I can go on every day, so I'm not even sure where that line should be, much less where the court will put it. But if you're writing your own piece of fan fiction, ask permission. Does it need permission to be safe? Once you start self-publishing, once you start selling it, you're more likely to come to someone's notice on a Google search, you're more likely to get people's good letter. If you want to, try to get a letter. Once you get a letter, you're ready to get it. Because so they know about you.
My question, I kind of have one that's really quick, short answer, and one that I just want you to touch on. The first question is, I'm writing a story based in my hometown, so I'm using landmarks. Some of them are public domain, but some of them are like restaurant names. Am I okay with that?
Mentioning the restaurants on that street is fine. If they're really practicing about the restaurant, they'll
okay.
But yes, if you're using a real setting, you're allowed to describe that real setting. Because no one owns that real setting. If you put it on the enterprise,
yeah. And then my question is, I'm planning on writing under a pseudonym. So what kind of copyright advice can you give for that?
I have a work on something I'm working on. It's not finished, but enough people know about it that I feel like I should copyright what I have. When I'm finished with the final, how does that affect what I've already copyrighted, or does it? Even if they have the same title? The title is really cool. The title is really cool. Should I trademark that or just copyright the title till I'm done? Thank you.
Because you also won't really be able to stop someone else from publishing under that same name. That's not how it works.
Thank you. I'm making art from movies, but making it in mainly painting and paper cutout and such. Is that covered under free
That's
use?
Infringement.
It's an infringement?
Yep.
Okay.
You're
feeling. Okay. Hi. I'm doing bloody, 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 blah. But What if something that I want to copyright, I change the media of it and do something else? Like,
you've made a derivative of your own work and you've copied the new work.
Okay, so if somebody else were to do something in a different medium.
Okay, what do you mean by different medium?
Like, say I write a novel, but somebody else writes a screenplay.
That is an adaptation. It's a derivative work. You have the rights to write a screenplay from your novel unless you authorize someone else to do it. When the screenplay is completed, you should copyright, assuming you did it, you should copyright it as well, and you have a new copyright in the new materials. You don't get a new copyright in the old materials. That mattered a lot under the previous act when old things fell out of copyright. Now, all of your stuff's going to go out of copyright at the same time when you're dead, so it doesn't matter. But you get new copyright in the new material in your derivative work. If you authorize someone else to do it, part of the terms of when you negotiate with them giving the permission is going to be, do they get the copyright or do you get the copyright? And who owns the copyright and what can they do with it? Think of your rights and copyright. It's a really boring analogy, but it's one law press was used, and I haven't come up with a better one. It's a bundle of sticks. It's the right to copy, it's the right to adapt, it's the right to publish, it's the right to perform. All of these rights I own. And I can give away individual pieces of my bundle of sticks. And I can give them away on whatever terms I want to. I can give them away for lots of money. I can give them away for free. It's up to me, and if anyone will pay me lots of money for them. I can give it away for a limited term. I can give it away for the life of the copyright. Although, if you do give away rights for the life of the copyright, 35 years later, you can take it back. That's just how the copyright law acts. So you can always get your rights back 35 years later. But so you're going to determine the rights that someone else can have on your work. And if you make the screenplay from your novel, file the screenplay also. It's a new work, it's a derivative work, and it can get an independent copyright.
Okay.
I have my own custom t-shirt company, and that deals primarily with cosplayers. Now, I know I can go to DeviantArt and get permission from the artist to use their works, but what if I want to use something like The Incredible Hulk and put a phrase on it? This is probably under the vagueness of fair use, and call it The Incredible Bulk. You know, is that permissible? Because I'm using someone's copyrighted image, I would imagine, still. Yeah, that's what I would think. Yeah.
Incredible Bulk.
Well, that was just a vague term. No.
maybe you'll get away with that as parody, maybe not. Again, the problem becomes that mission problem.
Yeah, and I'd rather not find that out the hard way.
Are you likely to get in trouble, and how much trouble is it? Well, realistically, you're first going to get a piece of this letter. If you got to get a piece of this letter, you better see them back and note saying, okay, done. Don't argue because the next thing that happens is the trial. They will file the papers and you will have to respond or you're found. They'll rule against you as a default. You may have to pay huge damage if you were in there to talk about. So you could say, wait, there's no way I cost you $5 million because if you don't show up for the trial, if you don't file the papers to respond to the client, if you don't file the counterclaim, you don't have to respond, you don't file the answer, all the litigation is. If you don't do that, they get a judgment default. Would you not be there to say, no, wait, that's bullshit? So you can't just ignore the pending lawsuit. Usually once you get the assist from an on-job lawyer, you're better. I've heard people say, oh, you have a year and a day to respond to that. And I don't know where this stuff comes from. I don't know what you were reading. No, you don't have a year and a day. You've probably got how much time they give you because they will file it. The thing to assist, honestly, is just a courtesy. It's saying, I'm giving you the chance to stop. Because if you don't, I'm going to sue you. Now, I will confess, I have written some cease and desist letters. No, it's not a problem. I have written some, and they were complete flops. I'm not going to sue them. My client didn't have any money to sue, or they would have hired one of my litigator friends to sue them. So I wrote very sternly worded cease and desist letters. Usually work. But most of them are not from transactional academic checks or lawsuits. Usually when you get cease and desist letters, you come for on job lawyer, and they're ready to file cases. And they found out about this. You're no longer going to have to rent. Sometimes it's written to like speeding. You know, it's always against the law, but you don't always get
it. I host trivia competition panels at various conventions throughout the Southeast. Most of them are styled like classic game shows. So we're recreating the game shows. I custom program everything myself from scratch. And we're having some of the issues with trying to contact people of television studios that no longer exist because some of these shows date back to the 50s, 60s, and 70s. That's the question.
Copyright records were never computerized in the past. They're starting now, which is kind of cool. Until recently, you had no simple way of finding out unless you went and dug through the archives and the Library of Congress, even then you might not find out. So sometimes it's really very hard to get permission to do it. Now that cuts both ways. If you're working for a professional enough, like commission or a company that won't let you do anything without permission, then the practice lender is, since you can't figure out who has permission, you can't get permission. The other side of it, on a more pragmatic level, if you don't have a parent company who wants to avoid infringement suits and therefore doesn't have this rule, or does have this rule, like if it's not one of those rules, all set up companies with their own lawyers, something is because of the fact that you can't figure out who owns it. They may not exist anymore, in which case there's no one to enforce it. It's not legal to use it, but there's no one left who cares if you do. But you still can get caught on it. And that's why most professional corporations that are running either media events or there's actually in Hollywood, it's a lot of times very difficult to use film clips for documentaries. Because to get permission to use a film clip, you have to get permission of everybody who owns any rights to it to get both the legal clearance to allow you to use the clip. Well, sometimes there's, big actors who weren't even mentioned in the credits, but according to the Screen Actors Guild, they have a right. And if you can't figure out who that guy in the sombrero was in Clint Eastwood's movie, you can't do that clip. You don't access contact with horses, but the rest of the company is. And so there's a lot of documentaries that want to use old film clips, and they can't because, PBS or BBC or any of the documentaries and Morgan channels. Even those companies won't allow anything to air that might get them into legal trouble. And the clearance folks can't approve it unless you have clearance for everything. And getting clearance here is a very short clip. You also have to figure out the music background, the composition, the sync license, the movie studio. You've got 100 people for a 30-second clip to that official trial. And three of them are wearing sunburns, they're napping in the sun as part of cleaning the background to see movies. And their faces, but yet they have copyright and clearance will let you go until you get it. So it's sometimes very difficult. And again, sometimes the pragmatic answer is, well, you check. If you're trying to do a BBC documentary, you can't do it. If you're just doing your own stuff, if you've made a good effort search to find who it is, then it's unlikely they'll find you. They may sit out there being quiet, and then they'll see you in the woods.
Mine is concerning partnership. Let's say if you have a web page or you come up with a design as partners and having them copyrighted. Is it copyrighted under the name, which is then split off into the two partnerships? And how long do those last if you're under a partnership?
Figure out in advance how you want things to be up, who's going to have control of what. Write the agreement before you publish anything. If you're having someone work on your website as a web developer, make sure you right now, who owns that? Who owns that copyright? Because the web developer comes up with a beautiful page. Unless you did it ahead of time to work based on hire, the web developer owns it. And if he later says you can no longer use your web page, you say, but I paid for a lot of money. Like, yeah, it's a direct contract. You can't use your web page. So anytime you're hiring someone to do creative work for you, make sure you have a contract that very clearly says who you're charged with. If you're hiring someone to do a certain kind of artwork for you, you need to be working on a hire agreement, and it's probably on your plan list. But if you're just being run past the letter, make sure that you have matched blanks out of the statute. As a general rule, guys, anything you download off the internet for legal form is exactly what you pay for it, and you pay nothing. The contract you can download is crap. They're written usually by non-lawyers. They're written for other deals. They don't apply to yours. You don't know what any of it means. You just agree to stuff that you don't understand. So you're much better off writing your agreement out in English, in your own language, than you are downloading something off the net, because it's crap.
unless you have access to some of the inner halls of some of the legal sources, which, unless you're a lawyer, you don't. We do that out.
So if you have my work, then the term is the last guy of the office, so that draft that long, have a little guy right away. If you do it in a partnership, then it's going to be corporate owned, and then the year is 95 years past.
I'm a jewelry designer, and I have a line of bracelets that's inspired, not copied, but actually inspired by a celebrity and a show, and a show that I've actually never seen, but someone said, oh, this looks like this show, something they'd wear on it. And I said, okay, well, I'll just put the tag on Facebook as inspired by. It kind of, I just went with it. Is that legal? Is that okay to use it either on my website as a description or a tag in any way? To use the celebrity name if it looks like something they would wear, if it was inspired by them, or in a description or in the tagging.
You're probably safer saying
inspired by. Inspired by. Okay.
I don't know for sure on that honestly. So I would not use the celebrity name in attachment to your bracelet directly. Because that implies the celebrity endorsing just to do that.
Okay.
It inspired by.
This is the best microphone ever, by the way.
It's
awesome. Right? Nice.
So this is cooler than you thought.
And they're $700.
Mm. Oh, that's why they wouldn't let me have it.
Cool. Anyway,
here,
as a concert photographer, when I take photos of Rush or Kiss or Coheed and Cambria or whoever, if I do not sign an agreement to shoot that show that says that they have the copyright, which I won't sign, occasionally I'm presented with them and I will not sign them, does that mean that I have the copyright to those photos? And how does that come into play if I want to start selling prints of Geddy Lee, for example?
If you took a photograph from a place that you were allowed to be in a public performance, you are allowed to sell those photographs. But most times the concert space does not allow photography. Now that everyone has a phone.
But I'm talking about as a professional concert photographer that's credentialed to shoot that show.
You're credentialed and allowed to be there. You haven't given them the copyright, and you own the copyright.
Okay, and so I'm allowed to sell prints. For profit.
Generally, yes, but read what you sign.
Well, no, if I didn't sign anything.
If you didn't sign anything.
Does the photographer have the rights to those images?
Read the tickets in a sense. It's going to depend on the terms under which you are present in that space.
Okay.
If by virtue of buying the ticket, you clicked, I agree to a couple things, and one of those things was you can't do that, then you can't do that. If they're like the Grateful Dead, you say, yeah, sure, set up your videos here. In fact, set your recording device up here because you'll get better sound. At a time when no one was allowed to bootleg concerts, that's where bootlegging came from, but bootlegging concerts was making illegal recordings of concerts.
Right.
Well, before everyone had recording devices in their pocket, right? Well, the Grateful Dead said, sure, go ahead. And they set up a place where you could go set up your recording devices, which was the best place in the sound system. So they had permission to do it, so it was legal. At other concerts, there was not permission given, and in fact, it was expressly prohibited. And so if you set that up, you were going to be kicked out for sure. You usually lose your equipment, which would suck back then because it was expensive.
Right.
And, they might prosecute. Well, same deal now. If they give you permission, shoot away. But you're not really in public. If you're a member of the paparazzi, you snap Geddy Lee walking down the street, you're good to go. You can take pictures of people in public and use those pictures, as long as you're not falsely attributing an actual endorsement to that celebrity. But the paparazzi don't get permission from the celebrities to use it. They sure as hell sell them. But by virtue of being inside the venue for their performance, you may have agreed somewhere to not do that.
And if I don't have a ticket, if I'm just given the photo pass and I didn't agree
somewhere
to anything?
Somewhere there was a term involved in that. If you have a photo pass, you know you're taking pictures. Somewhere it was written down what you can do. If, honest to God, they didn't do anything, they said, yeah, dude, come on, take some pictures. And that's the extent of your agreement, then you own the photographs and you can use them however you like.
Cool.
It usually is not the case, but if it is, then yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
Sorry.
I was wondering if I could get your opinion on what's called, I guess, first sale of copyrighted material, such as DVDs and such. Can the actual original copyright owner prevent others from selling it after they purchase the original copy?
No, that's the first sale doctrine.
doctrine. It is absolute law. Once, okay,
who's
got a
full question?
Here
you go.
Excellent, that'll work. Okay.
And this will probably be the last question in the whole time.
Okay. Okay. I bought this. I now own it. Okay, I stole this. He now owns it still. But if I had just bought this, what have I bought? A Dyson then.
Oh my, 1139.
Okay, so if I have purchased this DVD, I own this copy of the work. I do not own the underlying movie. I cannot license this movie to any of you. I cannot make a copy of this DVD. I own this physical copy. Now, I can do whatever I want to this physical copy. I can burn it, I can watch it, I can show it privately. I can sell it to you. He might be sick. But I can sell this to someone else because my rights are to this physical copy. I have no rights to the underlying work, but I have rights to this physical copy. And I can do whatever I want with it except things that violate his rights, like copy it, perform it, publish it, display it, those sorts of things. But anything to this copy, I may do. So the first sale doctrine basically extinguishes his rights to the sale of the copy after the first sale. So it's been sold to me. I can now resell it. Unless it's software and I clicked I agree, because I didn't purchase the software, I licensed it.
Yeah. Would that include things from overseas once they're in the U.S.?
Yes.
Okay.
You are allowed to make a copy for personal use. You're not allowed to make copies and sell them. But if it's like you used to be able to tape your albums onto a cassette tape. That was okay. I can copy a TV show on my VHS, on my DVR, and watch it later. That was a previous sale. But I can do that. But I can't make a copy.
Okay, one last question. Going back on... Alright, so continue on first sale doctrine for just a second. I know there was a lawsuit about a person who went and bought college textbooks overseas and brought them back to the United States and then resold them. I know that gentleman got sued over that because they were trying to...
There are different rules about importing goods from overseas. Mm-hmm. The terms on which they're sold overseas are different than here.
Okay.
If you're buying foreign goods and importing them, there's rules about that.
Okay.
And chances are if what you're trying to do is buy the goods cheap there and bring them back here, their rules say you can't.
Okay.
Those are complicated tariff stuff, and there's copyright laws that attach there too, but that's one of the exceptions to the first sale doctrines if you're running afoul of some of the import laws.
Okay.
That's right. An absolute no-no. But it's gonna. But there's exceptions to that as well when you're doing import-export business.
Okay.
And there's lots of really boring cases.
Right.
Those involve shampoo. Are we out of time?
Yeah.
We are out of time. Thank you much.